Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hello there. It's Nate here with another edition of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and vinyl fans worldwide. Today, we've got a very special show. I'm going to be talking about Cadet Concept Records. Now, Cadet Concept Records was a label out of the very early 70s, fairly insignificant output historically, musically. However, there were two releases that came out from Cadet Concept, which are really quite interesting. Quite phenomenal, actually. We're going to speak about those a little bit later today, as well as how to find them and how to know what they're worth if you do run across them, because there are a few different versions. We want to make sure we spell out the differences for you. Also, I'll be talking a little bit about my existential crisis with my turntable this weekend. In the meantime, you can always give me a quick email, Nate, N-A-T-E, at thevinylguide.com, or follow or tag me on Instagram at vinylguide. So something happened to me this week, and I thought I'd share it with you guys because I think many of you could probably relate, being a bit of a record nut. I'm sure many of you are in that same situation. I also have a family. I think I've shared that before, wife and two kids. I've got a regular job. I've got a lot going on in my life, and I'm making time to do this podcast, which is really fun. It is something I really look forward to, and I try not to take too much time away from other things, other obligations in my life. In fact, I think the thing I'm giving up most about doing this podcast is sleep, which again, happy to forego that because I love talking records and sharing this sort of information. So it's been real busy around the house the last few weeks. And I get home the other night quite late, and my wife is there with this look on her face, this, we got to talk look. I don't think it's very serious. It wasn't like, oh my God, someone died or you're about to die. It was one of those things where I just knew she was perturbed about something. So we sat down. I did the good husband thing. Okay, honey, what's going on? And she let it all out. And it wasn't huge. It wasn't this torrent of complaints or belly aching or anything like that. I thought she had a very reasonable request. Essentially, she had noticed that since we were all busy the last few weeks, work and kids and podcasts and all this other stuff, that there were a lot of items around the house that had just started to pile up and get neglected. And fair enough, we're not living in squalor. There's not, cockroaches running around the place. But, you got kids, you get all sorts of, piles of stuff. There were clothes that probably should have been put away a week ago. There were dishes that we just hadn't got around to, stuff that hadn't got put away, counters that had just gotten messy and mail all over the place and that sort of thing. So I understood. I got it. I understand. And she's very sensitive to, kind of wanting to keep a clean house. We also have a lot of stuff coming up in the next few weeks, so we knew we wouldn't get much of a chance to do it. However, this being Friday night, that weekend, the Saturday and Sunday, I had really had very little planned. So I made the deal with her to where, okay, tomorrow, Saturday, I'll stay home and I will do all the cleaning. How about that? Good deal, yeah. Now, I'm thinking to myself, now, guys, you may have had these sort of experiences before. I'm thinking to myself, she's going to take the kids, get them out of here for 4 or 5 hours. I'm going to clean, but also listen to all these records while I clean. These things, I've got a little stack that I haven't quite gotten to yet, and I'm just going to have a great day just by myself. The men, I think, call that cave time. It's very good to kind of have that cave time, that alone time. You get some shit done, and it works out good for everybody. She gets a house clean. I get to listen to my records. Whoop-de-doo. So the plan is in motion. Everybody is going to be happy, I think. So Saturday morning comes around. I'm making breakfast for the kids. I know they're getting ready to get out of here, and I'm going to have the house to myself. And I'm listening to a record that's new to me. It's Otis Redding, the Soul album on Volt. And I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking, that sounds really distorted. There's something kind of wrong with that. So I go over to the turntable. I look at the record. Record looks pretty clean. Nothing shocking about it. I dust it off a little bit more, and as I go to put the stylus on the record, I notice the stylus, rather than hanging straight down, is bent at like a 30-degree angle. And I am like, oh, God. Okay, well, first off, there's my problem. Second off, I can no longer play any records with that stylus. That stylus is going to ruin some records. Now, by the way, records are pretty resilient. They can handle a little bit of abuse, but I don't want to take that chance, especially with a bent stylus like that. Now, the big problem that I had was that was my backup stylus. I'd only replaced it about 2 or 3 weeks earlier, and I hadn't got around to ordering a replacement. So, essentially, I was not going to be able to listen to records that day after I'd made that commitment that I was going to stay home and clean. So, okay. Now, total first world problems, I get it. Most of you are saying, oh, big deal, what are you going to do? Well, to me, I needed to have that plan go in order. I'm a little bit OCD, so what do I do? So I need to give you a little bit of insight as well as to what it's like to shop in Australia. For those of you who haven't spent enough time in Australia, here's kind of how it goes. The majority of shops in Australia close at around 5 o'clock every night. And not that many shops are open on Sundays. So if you need to get stuff done, if you need to buy something, and you work kind of regular 9 to 5 hours, then it's actually very difficult. You either have to go Thursday evenings, which is late night shopping. That's when a lot of shops stay open from 5 p.m. to like maybe 8 or 9 p.m. Or early Saturday morning. Otherwise, you're pretty screwed. You just kind of have to wait it out. So I start calling around. This being Saturday morning, I know that I've only got a couple hours maybe to fix this problem. Otherwise, I'm going to have to wait till probably Tuesday or Wednesday when I can make some time to go out and get this stylus. So housework immediately put on hold. I start calling around, and I got my buddy Phil, who owns the Vintage Record. Unfortunately, that's about, maybe with Saturday traffic, that's an hour each way. So I'm calculating, okay, I can go over to Phil's. I'm sure he'll have something in stock. However, that's 2 hours driving. I know I'm going to want to stay there for a while. We're going to talk. I'm probably going to see something I want to buy. This could be a very expensive trip for me, and there goes my entire Saturday. So I kept Phil's as an option, kind of maybe if I need to do it, I know it's there. So I start calling around, and I found this one shop in this area that near where I live called Hornsby, less than a 10-minute drive. And there's a turntable repair guy, but he's not there on Saturday. So, you know, I left a message after I heard kind of his answering service. And luckily, this guy's name is, he runs a business called the Spin Doctor. He was checking his messages that weekend. He hears my message, which probably sounded like, I need a needle, a big emergency problem, you know, help, big issue. You know, it must have just been a jumbled mess. So obviously, this guy from the Spin Doctor knew that, you know, I was disturbed or it was an emergency for me. Anyway, he calls me back and he says, look, mate, if you could bring this thing over to me, I'll take care of you. But here's the thing. I'm not at the shop today. You'll have to bring it by my house. And I'm thinking, whoa, I mean, that's fine and everything, but man, did this guy go out of his way for me. Some guy that he related to the position I was in. He's also got kids as well, by the way. So I think he understood this is a kind of a time of crisis. A brother in arms needs his help. So anyway, I, of course, took him up on his offer, went over to his house with the turntable. He looked at it. He didn't have a replacement stylus. It was an AT, an Audio-Technica 95E or whatever. And he says, look, what I have this Ortofon 2M Red. So it's a bit more, but you're going to hear it in the sound. So he hooked me up. I'm back home really within about 30, 35 minutes, ready to do the cleaning with this brand new Ortofon stylus. So there's two things here that I learned this week. Number one, always have a backup. Always, maybe even always have a backup for your backup, especially when it comes to a stylus. Always have one handy because you never know when something's going to happen. You're going to need it, and you need to be able to swap it out. So yeah, I'm ordering two backups right now. The second thing that I learned is Ortofon styluses kick ass. I mean, once Ortofon, never back. That's my new my new motto. So I love this new Ortofon. I'm absolutely hooked, and wow, I'm very impressed by the sound. Many of you guys probably already knew that before me, but I'm just learning this lesson now. So I do want to give a big Vinyl Guide huzzah to the Spin Doctor in Hornsby, New South Wales. Also to Ortofon for making such a kick-ass product. Anyway, that's my story. Maybe you guys have had a bit of craziness as well. I do not like to have the turntable broken for any length of time. Records are such a central part of what I do. I feel nude. I feel like I don't have skin if I don't have a turntable, working turntable that I could use. Anyway, that's just me, my craziness. Are you guys that crazy? Oh, hopefully not. So let's get to the record collecting part of today's show. Now, as mentioned earlier, today I want to discuss a few releases from the Cadet Concept record label. Now, Cadet Concept was an experimental label set up by Marshall Chess. He was the son of Leonard and Philip Chess, founders of Chess Records. Now, looking back at Cadet Concept as a record label, they really didn't have any significant impact musically or culturally, with the exception of two releases. So, to really tell the story properly, we have to go back in time a little bit, tell the story of Chess Records. So in the 1930s, the two brothers, Lejar and Faisal Chess, they escaped pre-Nazi Poland. These were Jewish kids, so they got out really just in time. The two brothers settled in Chicago where, newly immigrated with cultural and language barriers, they lived in some of the poorest neighborhoods of the city. Now, Lejar and Faisal eventually became Americanized, and they changed their names to Leonard and Philip Chess. As boys and then teenagers, Leonard and Philip did odd jobs. However, with such an intense work ethic that by the time they were in their early 20s, they owned and operated a nightclub, the Macamba, on Chicago's South Side. The Macamba catered to the urban crowd, and the Chess brothers booked black entertainers, of course, kept their customers happy and spending money, but it was a real tough business. The Chess brothers had to arm themselves. They had to carry guns to ensure that they made it home each night with the proceeds of that evening's business. Now, eventually, the Chess brothers were made aware of a local husband and wife, Charles and Evelyn Aaron, who had recently started up a record label they called Aristocrat Records. Now, very typical of record labels, Aristocrat was always short of funding. And the Chess brothers saw an opportunity, they bought into the business, and then connected some of the artists that they employed at the Macamba Club to record and release music on the struggling Aristocrat record label. And Aristocrat focused on blues and the newly emerging trend that would eventually become rock and roll. However, they were a bit too early on this trend, and artistically and stylistically, they kind of spread themselves a bit too thin. Eventually, Charles, Evelyn, and all other investors in Aristocrat Records were bought out by the Chess brothers, who, in 1950, renamed the record label after themselves and brought over just a handful of artists, including one McKinley Morganfield. McKinley Morganfield was born in Mississippi somewhere between 1913 and 1915. Nobody is sure. He was raised on a plantation where he started playing guitar and learning from the various musicians who traveled through town, including, incredibly so, Son House and Robert Johnson. Now, McKinley continued down the occasional destructive path of being a musician. He eventually made it to Chicago, where he recorded for Columbia Records, then Aristocrat Records, and finally on the Chess record label, where he was more widely known by his nickname, Muddy Waters. And while at the Chess record label, Muddy Waters wrote and performed some of his biggest hits, including Got My Mojo Workin', Hoochie Coochie Man, and the song that inspired the group and the magazine of the same name, Rolling Stone. Muddy Waters' style of rollicking, sped-up blues riffs is a cornerstone of rock and roll music, and his contributions to the art form cannot be overstated. And another artist that recorded for Chess Records was one Chester Arthur Burnett, or more widely known as Howlin' Wolf. Wolf was born in 1910, also in Mississippi, where he grew up to be 6'3", 275 pounds. He was a tree of a man. He learned how to play harmonica, guitar, he was a singer, and at times he shared the stage with traveling blues legends like Charlie Patton, Robert Johnson, Johnny Shines, and a whole lot more. Now, Howlin' Wolf eventually made it to Memphis, where he recorded with Sam Phillips in the Sun Recording Studios, which those recordings brought him to the attention of the Chess Brothers, who secured him to a contract in 1952. While with Chess Records, Wolf gave them early hits like Smokestack Lightning, Backdoor Man, and Killin' Floor, a song which earned him a writing credit on Led Zeppelin's The Lemon Song, which borrowed heavily from Wolf's track. And even though Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf are huge personalities, they need to make room for a third person in this story, Marshall Chess. Now, Marshall Chess was born in Chicago in 1942, the son of Leonard Chess and the nephew of Philip. Marshall grew up around the family business, spending most evenings cleaning up the Chess Records office, sweeping floors, emptying ashtrays, collecting beer bottles after recording sessions. He was raised in a recording studio, raised as a record man. He hung out with musicians. He knew the business. And he eventually matured into a young man with musical ideas and aspirations all his own. In the late 1960s, Marshall Chess was inspired by the other music that was starting to gain popularity at the time. Bands like the Yardbirds, Cream, Hendrix, they were all part of this new soundtrack to the social changes and quote-unquote psychedelic perspectives taking root with the youth of the day. And so much so, Marshall convinced his father and uncle to help bankroll a new record label, an affiliate he called Cadet Concept, based on the then property of the Chess Brothers, Cadet Records. Now, a quick interesting side note, Cadet Records came into being when the Chess Brothers realized that their original jazz offshoot label, Argo Records, was not the only Argo Records around. Now, even though Argo Records from Chicago had artists like Illinois Jacquet, Babyface Ouellette, Yusef Lateef, artists that were widely known in the States, there was yet another Argo Records out of the UK. So the Chess Brothers sucked it in, renamed Argo Records to Cadet Records. And that's the story of Cadet Records. Now, Marshall's idea was that Cadet Concept would serve as a bit of an experiment to introduce new psychedelic sounds and to market to the youth of the day. Now, the first band on the label was a group called Rotary Connection, an affiliation of musicians who took prior hits and, for lack of a better term, psychedelicized them. They took those tracks, the melodies that people were familiar with, songs by Bob Dylan, the Stones, even from some tracks from the Stax record label. And Rotary Connection would re-record new arrangements. They'd use fuzz boxes and wah-wah pedals and really turn that song into a psychedelic jam. So while working with Rotary Connection, Marshall Chess thought, rather than covering Dylan and the Stones and sending them royalties, why not do songs by artists on the Chess label and keep it all within the family? Now, that was a bit of a literal gesture because the Chess Brothers owned most of the publishing of the songs performed on their label. However, Marshall Chess took it one step further. Why not have the original artists redo some of their old catalog and have it serve as a bit of a reintroduction to the young record buyers of the day? So with the blessing of his father and uncle, Marshall Chess recruited Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, two of Chess Records' best-known artists, to participate in a sonic rebranding of sorts. Each of them would belt out some of their best-known songs with the psychedelic backdrop performed by members of the Rotary Connection. Plan in hand, phase one of the recordings commenced in May of 1968 in Chicago. The sessions went extremely well, and Muddy Waters recorded these psychedelic versions of some of his old hits like Manish Boy, Hoochie Coochie Man. He even threw in a nod to Mick and Keith by recording a very powerful cover of Let's Spend the Night Together. By all accounts, Marshall Chess's plan to reinvigorate the career of Muddy Waters was going according to plan. Muddy's new album was even titled Electric Mud, and when it was released in October of that year, Electric Mud hit both the Billboard and Cashbox charts, selling over 150,000 copies in the first few weeks. That was a tremendous success by anyone's measurement. The early early success of Electric Mud prompted Marshall Chesta double down on his strategy and get Howlin' Wolf into the studio with the same formula, even with the same musicians. Wolf, however, was less impressed. He immediately disliked what these new musicians were doing to his sound. He described the versions as dog shit, and he famously told one of the session players, "Take those wah-wah pedals and throw them into the lake on the way to getting yourself a haircut." Unfortunately, Wolf needed the money, and he had to grit his teeth until the recording was done. So yes, his disposition on the sessions could be summarized as uncooperative, and this mood was leveraged for the album art and the marketing. Even though the album is simply known as the Howlin' Wolf album, the text on the cover clearly reads, "This is Howlin' Wolf's new album. He doesn't like it. He didn't like his electric guitar at first either." This was Marshall Chess's attempt at humor and wit. However, it's fair to say that few others were equally amused. By the time the Howlin' Wolf album was mixed and ready for pressing, Rolling Stone published a harsh review on the Muddy Waters' Electric Mud LP. In the review, they lambasted Chess for tinkering with the sound so well known, calling the album a parody, and stating that the record, quote, "does a great disservice to one of the blues' most important innovators and prostitutes the contemporary styles to which his pioneering efforts have led." Ouch. Muddy's sentiment toward this LP, originally accepting and optimistic, also started diminishing as well. It was the best-selling LP of his career to date, and charted the highest. However, it was a sidestep to the music that he felt most comfortable making. Now, in the wake of this, the Howlin' Wolf album was released and barely made a dent on the Billboard chart. In January of 1969, the final attempt to this formula was made when Muddy Waters recorded the tracks for what became his LP, After the Rain. Now, while the pace and the fuzz boxes were kept, the psychedelic perspective was minimized. Muddy's guitar playing is much heavier in the mix, but the LP was dumped on the market, dead on arrival. Cadet Concept stopped producing releases in 1970. Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters went off to repair their reputation and their careers, and Marshall Chess turned his energy into running Rolling Stone Records, a brand new vanity label made by the English lads who were initially inspired by the music his father and uncle helped release. Now, for you record collectors out there, here's what you need to know about these Cadet Concept releases. Muddy Waters' Electric Mud, catalog number LPS314, was originally pressed with two types of cover art: black text on a white background and white text on a black background. While we're not clear on the exact ratios, the white text on the black background version is most rare. The first press record labels themselves are with a white-gray background with pink and orange Cadet Concept writing, as well as the Chess Records Night logo. Now, what many people may not realize is that the Electric Mud first pressing came not only with a gatefold sleeve, but with an 8-page booklet featuring pictures of Muddy Waters getting his hair done. Now, it's very amusing to see the pictures. I'll post the pictures in my Instagram at Vinyl Guide. But the entire booklet is Muddy with his hair in curlers, kind of going through the motions, with what I assume is all in preparation for the picture inside the gatefold. This picture is Muddy Waters looking straight at the camera with his guitar in hand and this marvelous head of hair. Now, many people with this pressing don't know about the booklet, and more than once I've found used copies for cheap, and the sellers really had no idea that the booklet was in the record sleeve for 45 years unviewed. If you find a used copy, make sure you look closely in the sleeve. You may find a booklet tucked away in there. Used copies in nice shape of the first pressing go for about $40 or $50, but with the booklet, this price can easily double. On the other hand, the Howlin' Wolf LP, catalog number LPS-319 did not have a gatefold sleeve. The record label is the same white-gray background with pink and orange cadet concept logo. However, the Howlin' Wolf album also came with a small mail-in insert, you know, those little postcards pre-addressed to the Chess record offices so you could sign up for new releases from Chess and Cadet Concept Records. First pressings of the Howlin' Wolf album currently go for around US$40. Now, both Electric Mud and the Howlin' Wolf LP have had a few reissues through the years, but this is after they were reverted back to the Cadet record label after the Cadet Concept record label was officially folded. The repressing labels tend to be orange and pink Cadet labels, although I do occasionally see the same labels with green artwork. These typically go for around $15 or $20. The second pressing of the Howlin' Wolf album features the same cover with the same text. However, rather than using black text, like the original press does, it uses this very bright pink text. So you could quickly tell a second pressing of the Howlin' Wolf album without even opening it. And while we're on the subject of Cadet Concept Records, there's one other semi-interesting first pressing story, and that is with the debut album from Rotary Connection, catalog number LPS-312. Now, it's a black cover with a design on the front. However, the interesting bit's on the back. On the back side, there's a picture of a hymnal book. And around and on the book, there are various objects like rocks and bugs and a band photo. On the very first pressing, on the left page of the book, there is a marijuana leaf. However, this being 1968 and pot was still being seen as a big unknown menace, subsequent pressings covered this pot leaf image with that of a picture of a person, maybe a band member or one of their friends, and this guy's got these big spinning eyeballs. So no one really cares a whole lot about Rotary Connection these days, so the price difference between the first press and the cover-up pot press is very minimal. You could have either for $5 or $10 easy. So that's the story of Cadet Concept and blues legends Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf. It wouldn't be fair to end this episode without also adding that these two LPs have become legendary in their own right, especially Electric Mud, which has been cited as highly influential by artists like Chuck D from Public Enemy, the Rolling Stones, even John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin cites Electric Mud as the inspiration for the riff they used in Black Dog. And personally, I really enjoy these LPs. I still keep Electric Mud in my car iPod for times that I want to drive fast with the windows down. It is a real ass kicker, and it's quite nice to see it starting to get some of the respect it deserves. Well, that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Really do appreciate you guys tuning in, and I hope you guys find some copies of Electric Mud and the Howlin' Wolf album out there. They are to be had, and I hope some of you guys find the booklets and the secret stuff in them as well. Shoot me an email, send me some pictures if you have copies of these with any new information. Nate, N-A-T-E, at thevinylguide.com, or put them on Instagram and tag me at vinylguide. Again, really do appreciate it and hope you guys are doing well. Till next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.